For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host, Red Sale.
And I'm Robert Kirkwood. And coming up in today's show,
Alison Rudd introduces us to her underground psychological mystery, 11 Lines to Somewhere.
We'll hear from Mike Ingham, MBE, about his autobiography, After Extra Time and Penalties.
And then we'll return to Alison Rudd for the books of her life.
All that coming up in today's Read On.
After 2 decades of working as a sports journalist and playing football for Leighton Orient women's team, Alison Rudd has turned her hand to fiction. Her debut novel, The First Time Lauren Paling Died, is available from the RNIB Talking Books Library, where it will soon be joined by her follow-up, 11 Lines to Somewhere. She joined me via Zoom to tell me about both books. Alison Rudd, welcome to Read On.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we've got your first novel in the RNIB library, and it's a twisty, turny, uplifting mystery. Can you tell us a little bit about The First Time Lauren Paling Died?
Yes, thank you for asking. As you say, it's my first novel, and I suppose it's a tiny bit like Sliding Doors, if anyone's ever heard of that film, where it's about parallel lives. And the premise of the book is that if you or I, Red, were to die this minute, we wouldn't die. We'd die in the world we are in, but we would carry on living our lives till its natural conclusion in another parallel world. And there are very many proper physicists out there who believe in multi-world theory, and that there are billions and billions and trillions of other worlds like ours where the differences could be quite huge, or the differences could be incredibly nuanced. So what you have in my book is Lauren dies aged 13, and she slips into a world that's almost the same. So under normal rules circumstances, she wouldn't know she'd died, but there's enough that's different to make her suspicious that she doesn't belong. I should just finally add that the other premise of the book is that no one else in the world but Lauren Paling is aware that she has died and gone somewhere else. The point of this philosophy, if you like, is that you just carry on not knowing. Otherwise, it would be awful, wouldn't it, if we all knew we'd died and left behind the people who loved us. So she's the only one that realises this is the way the world and life works.
So other people carry on their lives, do their grieving, move on, and Lauren is still out there, and she doesn't just die once, does she?
Well, no. I mean, if you're a writer, you couldn't possibly, with that premise, not have her die again. So it was irresistible. But I did resist her dying too many times, Red, because that would just be too sad for words. As it is, actually, there's a lot of grief in the book, because every time someone dies, they do leave people behind. Mm. So when she dies a second time, there's another host of grieving to be done. So what I do is I keep one world that is this world, and that is the world inhabited by her father, Bob. And we carry on. And everything he knows are the things we're aware of, the current affairs, the sport, so on. He's in our world, but everybody else is in different universes. So we see different ways in which people react to her death. So in one world, her mother doesn't cope well. And in another parallel world, her mother does cope reasonably well. So the joy of it for me, Red, was contemplating that life isn't just on one single track. There are different outcomes to big events. And if you were able to go back and cope again with something big, you might do it differently, for example, that there's no set route. So I liked the fact that I had different outcomes to one event throughout the novel and tried to bring them together. And I also thought it was important that there were other constants in the parallel, different worlds. So in one, there's a chap who's the boss of Bob, and Bob is Lauren's dad, as I said, and he always goes missing. So it doesn't matter which of the universes you're in, he always goes missing. And hopefully the reader's thinking, if we can find out what happened to Bob's boss, this will all make sense to us, and there'll be a meaning to this woman having to go through different universes to carry on her own life.
It's a very positive way of examining our reactions to death, which is a subject we're not very happy talking about in company, but many books have death at their centre.
Well, it's almost the taboo, really, that it's the one thing that happens to us all. It's the one thing we will all know about and have to come to terms with, but we're really good at avoiding it. And I think a lot of literature wants to use that and tap into our fear of it and the fact that it is an unknown. But they do so often and make it almost funny, if you like. So a lot of murder mysteries, they're not really about the death and they're not about the ending of a life. They're about the puzzle and the gain from death, and as though it's all one big chess game. And I wanted to explore that very personal reaction that if someone you love dies and you know you will never see them again, how on earth do you pick up the pieces and get meaning back into your life? And once you decide you're not going to just brush over death as a plot device, I think you owe it to the reader to explore. And I got one letter soon after Lauren Paling came out from a man who'd just lost his wife, and he said reading the book helped him come to terms with his grief. And that, of all the nice things people have said and all the reaction I've had, that was the one that meant most to me, because it's only by talking about death and grief that you can possibly really come to terms with it.
Yes, I've always been struck that if you stop talking about somebody who's died, they've died twice in many ways.
Oh, golly, yes. And there's a friend of mine, her son died when he was 11, and she's got to know lots and lots of bereaved parents. And now she's stronger. She helps them through their grief. And one of the things that's very important to them is that when they get a Christmas card from friends, they don't leave off the name of the child who's died. It's almost an embarrassment for some people that there's been a death in the family and they really don't want to talk about it. And they'll come along and they'll think they can jolly you up and give you a cup of tea and talk about the weather. Well, anything but the thing that is most important, that big hole in their lives. And if you bother to talk to people who are bereaved, they will say, please don't pretend they never existed. Of course they exist and I want to talk about them. I think the mistake we make is we think if people want to talk about the dead, that they're being deluded in some way and they've got to get their act together and carry on and not live in the past. And it isn't that at all. It's, as you say, it's a way of them not dying twice.
Now, as I said, the first time Lauren Paling died is in the RNIB Talking Books Library, and it's been vividly brought to life by Chloe Massey. Did you have anything to do with the selection of her as a narrator?
No, the publisher very kindly said they'd found Chloe and let me listen to some of her previous work and said, did I like her voice? And as a large part of the book dips in and out of the northwest of England, I felt she got the accents right. So that mattered to me.
One Thursday after school the following summer, Lauren was sat in her bedroom on her sheepskin rug, making a birthday card for her mother and sipping occasionally from a plastic tumbler full of cream soda, each sip evoking the seductively sweet smell of Lenny's van. She was immensely proud that her rug was white, white like a sheep, and not dyed pink like the one in the bedroom of her friend Debbie. Lauren's current obsession was to create pictures with complicated skies. She was using the stencil of a crescent moon when, to her right, a thin beam appeared, which to most observers, had they been able to see it at all, would have looked like a sharp shaft of sunlight. Lauren knew better. She sighed and tried to ignore it by pressing her nose against her artwork and wondering how paper was manufactured and how so much of it was stored in her father's big steel desk, which sat incongruously in the spare bedroom. She had once covered the desk with stickers of stars and rainbows and was still not sure if her father had been cross or had pretended to be cross, but quietly found it as loving a gesture as she had hoped. Grown-ups, she thought, were always secretive. They were so secretive that it was possible they all saw special sunbeams which, if peered through, granted tiny windows into other worlds too. Lauren doubted it, but she, on the other hand, had been visited by these peculiar, dangerous sunbeams for as long as she could recall. 2 years ago, when Lauren was six, a steel sunbeam had appeared in the kitchen, and Lauren's mother had walked straight through it. Lauren had caught her breath, waiting for her mummy to clutch her head and sit down trembling, perhaps even to fall through to another place, but nothing had happened. And so, over time, Lauren came to understand that the curious metal rod-straight beams belonged to her, and only to her.
Chloe Massey narrating The First Time Lauren Paling Died, written by my guest, Alison Rudd. So, Alison, will Chloe be narrating your new book, which is due to come out in July?
No, I know it is a man who's going to read that for you, because I think the protagonist really is a guy called Ryan. And I say, I wrote it, you'd think I'd know, wouldn't you, Red? But I mean, there are two main characters, a man and a woman, but it's really written from Ryan's point of view. So I think we all felt a male narrator would be best.
Now, I love the premise of the new book, being a Londoner and a tube traveller. 11 lines to somewhere just sums up my daily life. It's a book that's set on the tube and about the tube and a girl who never seems to leave the tube network.
Yeah, I thought this would be a really nice idea for a story, actually, because most people, even if they don't live in London, they know what the tube is and they know what an underground network system is, and they'll either be scared of it or love it or have it in their lives too much. It sort of becomes part of your life if you commute, doesn't it? But I love the idea of having some sort of mystery on the underground. When you think about it, we've got this labyrinth under us, and that's the perfect place for something mysterious to happen. And so a chap called Ryan, he gets the same train every day on the same carriage. And most of the time, there's an attractive woman in the same carriage. He becomes a little bit obsessed with her. But I must point out there are reasons why he's a little bit obsessed with her. He has an interesting backstory that makes him a bit romantic. And he decides to just stay on a bit longer than he normally does, just to see where she gets off. In the end, he sort of ends up accidentally on purpose following her around her commute, and she never gets off. So he has to decide, she's too weird, I really should stop doing this. But for various interesting reasons, he decides that no, he needs to know. He really needs to know why she doesn't get off, and does actually end up speaking to her. And to his amazement, she's witty and pleasant and lovely, and he can't work it out. Why would such an ordinary but almost wonderful person never get off the tube? So you're with him on this quest to find out why she doesn't get off. And it's like an unlocking story. So as soon as you know why, then the pair of them can maybe, just maybe, start to have a more normal, more normal relationship.
So again, it's got a mystery at its heart, but one that explores the emotions rather than a murder mystery type of puzzle.
Yes, absolutely. There's nothing too curious about it. Once you know everything, all the reasons why, they all make sense, and you should be able, as a reader, to identify with them. And out of a sort of peculiar premise, if you like, you discover the inner workings of the heart and the soul and why people interact the way they do. But I also think we're all strangers when we get on a train, and occasionally you make connections, and that's a lovely thing as well. If you think back to all the times people have spoken to you on a train, often it's only because something's gone wrong. And if you're stuck in a tunnel for longer than 3 minutes, people start to tut and pull funny faces, or there could be something terrible could happen and you would make lifelong friends from adversity. I mean, I have actually made friends on public transport. It can happen. But most of the time we sort of bury our heads in our newspaper or close our eyes and listen to music and don't want to interact. But it's a little waste in a way, if you think about it, all those new people to meet who you've got something in common with. You've all piled into the same train on the Hammersmith and City line, and you're probably all going into the city. So you'd probably have a lot in common with these strangers.
Yes, it's a great leveller. When you're in a train carriage, you are literally all in it together. And I agree, I've made friends on the train and the bus just by starting a random conversation.
Yeah, and do you keep in touch with them?
Yes, absolutely. It's one of those things where that little bit of help that I receive as a blind person on or off the carriage can quite often spark a conversation that carries on outside the tube station.
Actually, there's a man with a guide dog in the first chapter.
Even more reason for the RNIB library members to pick up the book and read it. Are you a fan of talking books yourself?
No, but I think I need to, because I've got a close friend who swears by them, and so I trust her opinion. I must do it. And I did listen to just the serialization on Radio 4 of the latest Hilary Mantel, and it was so beautifully done. I thought, why am I not listening more to books? I think it's just you get set in your ways, don't you? And I listen to so much current affairs and music. I sort of want to mix up how I imbibe my information, if you like. So I'm quite set in my ways. So I think you need to read a book and listen to music and not do too much, because I work so much on my laptop, for example. I don't really like reading a newspaper on my laptop, so I want the real paper. So I have all these little rules about how you go about amassing information and entertainment. But as I say, I think it's a growing thing. More and more people that I know love them. So maybe you, Red, are the person that's just pushed me over the edge, and I'm going to go for it.
Well, if you want any good recommendations, please download the Read On podcast.
I will.
You mentioned the way you work, and I believe there's quite a funny story about the chaos of your office.
Yes. I've been really lucky, actually. I've only been burgled once. And so when I was quite hysterical, in fact, because for me to have woken up and seen things missing, it made me realise the burglars had been in the house while I was asleep and my children were asleep. And it did temporarily really freak me out. So I phoned the police and the police came round. And mainly because I kept saying, I think they were in the house. They were in the house when I was in the house. And otherwise, I don't think I'd have been too bothered. But anyway, so they went round the house, these two police officers, and they went in my little study. I'm really fond of my little study. And the police woman went, oh, my word, what have they done? This is awful. Did they do all this? And I said, oh, no, it normally looks like this. Because what I do is when I'm typing and researching, I'll have papers around me. And then when I finished, I throw them over my shoulder because that means they're finished. And then I'm completely deadline driven. So then I go on with the next thing. I mean, life's too short to tidy up what you've thrown over your shoulder. So my office was knee high in detritus, which did actually make me think, I have to tidy it up. So I announced it as a big announcement to my friends and family. I'm going to tidy my office. And those people who'd seen it were going, oh my goodness. And the things I found, Red, I mean, I found, found biscuits that were like 10 years old, and they were really disgusting, but it felt reasonably cathartic to do it.
Now that you've finished the second novel, have you begun work on a third?
At the very, very, very early stages, I can't tell you because it's not been agreed yet. So, I mean, what I think might be my third novel might not be. It's at the mapping it out stage. So not even a word written properly yet. But I'm looking forward to it.
Well, I shall wish you the best of luck with that. And in the meantime, we've got Lauren Paling to enjoy and 11 Lines to Somewhere to look forward to in July.
Thank you so much. Fred, take care.
The First Time Lauren Paling Died is available from the RNIB Library, where it'll be joined in July by 11 Lines to Somewhere. And Alison Rudd will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. Now, with the recent restart behind closed doors of the Premier League and now football matches being shown on TV, we were interested to hear about the release of an audiobook version of After Extra Time and Penalties, Memories of a BBC Football Correspondent by Mike Ingham. After almost a quarter century as the BBC's chief football correspondent, Mike Ingham, MBE, in his autobiography, shares a candid, comprehensive and sometimes controversial account of how the world of broadcasting and football changed beyond recognition throughout his career. A trip with his dad to the 1964 FA Cup final between Preston and West Ham was a life-changing moment for Mike, showing him the power of communication through commentary. Because while at that game, he noticed a man looking up to the sky with a big smile on his face, enjoying the match through the description and commentary from his sighted friend. Mike received many letters from blind and visually impaired listeners during his life as a broadcaster, including a note from the Right Honourable David Blunkett after his retirement, thanking him for bringing football to life over the years. Regular contributor to RNIB Connect Radio, Toby Davey, caught up with Mike via Zoom to chat with him about his early life supporting his local football club, Plymouth Argyle. His time at Radio Derby and at BBC Sport in Broadcasting House, working with some of the greats in sports broadcasting. Toby began by firstly asking Mike why he wanted to write after extra time and penalties, and why it was so important for him to record an audiobook version.
Well, I wanted to write the book for a couple of reasons, really, Toby. Having been a football correspondent for nearly a quarter of a century and lived through so many changes in my sport, football, and also in broadcasting as well, I just felt I wanted to document all of that. I mean, I particularly wanted to write something for my children to pass on as well through the family. And the other really important thing I wanted to do was to pay tribute in the book to some of the radio sport pioneers who were my mentors, who just helped me enormously. And I'm talking about great commentators like Peter Jones and Brian Butler, because there's never really been that much written about them. And I thought, well, I was lucky enough to work with these people, and I just felt obliged to do it, wanted to do it. And in terms of the audiobook, well, I think that's almost kind of self-explanatory, really, because I was deeply aware during my time as a broadcaster that many of the people who were listening to me relied on me because they weren't able to see. And so I thought, well, if I'm going to do a book, then it's just logical for them to be able to hear that book as well and hear my voice.
And you say in the book, from the age of seven, you always had an ambition to want to work at the BBC. Was that always in the back of your mind whilst you were going through school and university that you were desperate to get into the BBC and work there?
That's an interesting question. I'm not quite sure exactly the moment when I thought this is going to be the career and the pathway I want to pursue. I think in my early days as a seven-year-old, it was just more about my obsession with radio, I think. I was brainwashed by radio, really, as a child. And the reason for that was that it was always on in the home. I was born in 1950, and radio had really come into its own during the Second World War. Everybody had relied on it in the way that I think people have again over these last three or four difficult months. The only fantasy, really, that our black and white little television, we only had one channel on the television in those days. The only thing that could offer me, really, was cowboys and Indians films, you know. So that my senses were much more stirred by listening to music, listening to sport on the radio. I mean, for example, I can remember freezing January mornings when we lived in Wales, getting up and seeing my dad listening to the cricket commentary crackling through from Australia, you know, and I was sort of mesmerised by that. And I remember listening to all the children's favourites, the records, the Danny Kaye stuff, the Max Bygraves and everything else. And then a decade later, when I had my own little transistor, I'd take it off to bed with me and listen to Radio Luxembourg, and I loved hearing all the football commentaries coming from overseas. And even I was so obsessive that I used to even listen to the Test cricket on the radio and keep the score. You know, I used to keep the score listening to the Test cricket on the radio. And even now, I've only got to hear a piece of music, like, say, the Pick of the Pops theme or something like that, or the Hancock's half-hour music, to remind me of my radio days as a youngster. So I was completely indoctrinated by radio.
Back then, did you think that you would ever get there, and did you think that those ambitions that you had as a child would ever be fulfilled, sort of looking back now?
Well, you have to be very lucky, and I was very lucky. I was the beneficiary of sort of sliding doors experiences, and I know I was fortunate in many ways to get the breaks that I got, because when I started off in local radio, which was my foundation in Derby, they were wonderful years. I'd only had a couple of years of experience commentating for the Birmingham Hospital Radio Network when I was a student in Birmingham. I helped them out with some football and cricket commentary. It was awful. I mean, I would hate to hear that stuff now, you know, but at least it gave me something to knock on the door at Radio Derby with. And 'cause I'd been rejected by quite a few radio stations up until that day. So I knew I was being fortunate when they invited me in. And it just so happened that on that day, they'd heard that one of their staff was going on an attachment for 3 months. So they had a vacancy. So they asked me if I'd like to start, and I did. And I mean, I did crucial jobs in the early days, like reclaiming the tape, you know, so it could be used again for interviews and things like that. And it took me a couple of years before I was actually given a microphone and then started broadcasting.
Going back to the first match you ever went to with your dad, I think it was Plymouth Argyle at Home Park. Can you remember that experience of being there with your dad at first time and that sort of father-son experience?
Well, it was one of the happiest days of my life. It was one of those days that you never really want to end, because I'd had this sort of slow build-up to going to see Plymouth Argyle. I used to play for the Wolf Club Cubs in the park outside where the ground was. So when we were playing our games on a Saturday afternoon, if Argyle were at home, I could hear the crowd, and there was usually about 25,000 people in the ground. So again, that sort of got my senses working overtime. And I'd been told about some of the players at school, because two of my school colleagues used to go to the matches. And so when I finally did go with him, it was an FA Cup game against Gillingham. It just, everything about it was just, I mean, looking at it as a child, the whole experience, it seemed to me in those days, was just so much more theatrical than it is now anyway, because you didn't see the teams until they ran out at 5-3. They weren't on the pitch warming up or anything like that. You had a brass band playing before the game, and stood behind the goal. I had a little stool to stand on because I wasn't very tall. And there were no away fans either, because these were days before motorways. So, you know, there was no way that you were ever going to see anybody from another club at Home Park. And they were not a great side, but they gave me my foundation. And what's been wonderful for me now is that since retirement, I'm back in that area again. And I've been able to take my second son to see Argyle play, because I never had the chance to do that with my oldest boy, you know, because of my BBC commitments.
Yeah, great memories for both of you to cherish, I suspect, as well. And did you still get that sort of excitement and experience of your first match when you were going to games that you were reporting on, or was it a different experience?
Well, first of all, I think your relationship with footballers changes when you start working in the business. You become less starry-eyed. I mean, I was a Plymouth Argyle fan and then a Derby County fan when we moved, and couldn't support Plymouth anymore because we're just too far away. And so I used to idolise those players. But when I started to watch games and I was interviewing players, clearly the relationship changes, which is sad in a way, in that I did lose that. I suppose inevitably some of the games become routine, but the ones that always give you a tingle, you can never be ever complacent about going to see any England game, for example, especially in a World Cup or a European Championship. Always used to get a little tingle when the anthems were played before that game. All the big Champions League nights as well, they're nights that I really miss now. And FA Cup finals. FA Cup finals were always very special. In fact, I owe the FA Cup final everything, really, in terms of teaching me about the power of radio, about the power of communication, because my eyes were completely open the day my dad took me to see the West Ham-Preston game in 1964 at Wembley. And, for me, that was my kind of road to Damascus day. And you probably know that story, do you?
Yeah, I do. This the story of you going with your dad to the 1964 FA Cup final and listening to a Lancashire man commentating on the match to his blind friend. And you say in the book he was sort of smile on his face. He was looking up to the sky and really enjoying the match through the commentary from his friend. That's a real sort of standout moment for me in your book. And I wondered, as you say, sort of it affected your career in a way and gave you an experience that you may not have come across before. And how much of a changing experience was that particular moment? Because there are other changing moments in the book, but that one seems to stand out.
Well, it just demonstrated to me, really, the role of the commentator in the most amateur way, really, between these two lads, because the one that couldn't see, and he was just looking up at the sky, and he had his Preston shirt on and he had his big rosette and everything else, and had a lovely smile on his face, because I don't know what relation he was. He might have been his brother, he might just have been a friend, but he was describing the whole game to him. And it took me a few minutes to really work out what was going on. And then when I did realize, I was just mesmerized, really. I almost sort of started to listen to his commentary myself, you know. And I think for me, the golden rule of radio was that you're only really, or should be, commentating or communicating with one person, one listener. And I think if you believe the opposite to that, then you're kind of losing the plot, really, if you think you're talking to thousands, because it'll sound like that. And I probably had probably had two people in mind when I was commentating. I used to think about my next door neighbour when I was growing up, who became a sort of inherited uncle, and he encouraged me to follow my dreams. And he was interested in football without being completely obsessed with it. So in that way, I hoped, if I was thinking of him, I was pitching it at the right level. But then I also never forgot that moment at Wembley and that realisation that somebody was relying on those words to be able to enjoy the game. And in fact, when I did retire, and I received a lot of nice messages when I retired, probably the one that meant the most to me was a thank you from David Blunkett, the former Home Secretary, because obviously he's a blind listener, he's a passionate Sheffield fan, and over the years, you know, we must have brought him many moments of highs and lows from Bramall Lane. So in the back of my mind, I always try to think of my next door neighbour, and I always used to try and think of somebody who actually couldn't see the game, so they were needing our commentary even more.
And there are some great descriptive moments in the book when you, I think, describe one of the football pitches as a sort of sticky toffee pudding kind of pitch, and talking about Lowry sort of type skylines and stadiums and things like that. Was there always time to add in those descriptive moments compared to sort of commentating on what was happening on the pitch? Were you able to sort of give that full picture?
You had to, even amidst the hurly-burly of the game, try and make time for that light and shade. I think it's so important. I think, actually, football commentary is quite a simple procedure, really. I mean, some people do try and overcomplicate it, but obviously there's a world of difference, as everyone will appreciate, between a football commentary on the radio and on the television. And on the radio, you've got to try and make the listener feel that they're sitting next to you, ideally, at the venue, by, as you've just talked about, painting as many pictures as you can. My mentor, really, in football commentary, and your older listeners will remember Peter Jones, he was a master craftsman at this. If you ever listen to any of his commentaries, for the first 2 or 3 minutes, he would set the scene for you vividly, always in colour. He would describe the stadium, the weather, the fans, his vantage point. And then when the game started, he didn't try and describe everything that was happening in the game, because that's very difficult. It just sounds a bit of a jumble if you try and do that. So he let the game breathe. He took an overview like they do in the tennis, and he adhered to the two golden rules. And I think this is really important, Toby. The golden rules for me in radio commentary, first of all, is you've got to tell the listener where the ball is, and you've got to give the score. It sounds so simple, but you would be amazed how many people actually don't. So if you listen and you don't know where the ball is, then obviously you can't really follow the game. No. And the simple way of doing that, if I'll use an example, I mean, if Manchester United are playing in front of you, say, from left to right, and their right back is Gary Neville, if he's got the ball, you know, you say the ball is now with Gary Neville near side the right. I mean, that's absolutely crucial. It's not rocket science. And as a listener, I get infuriated if I don't know where the ball is and don't know what the score is. So geography, as well as painting those pictures you talked about, is the most important feature of any commentary. And then I think it's important also, thinking of the listener, to try and use your voice like a bit of a gearbox and not stay, you know, in one monotone level. You've got to try and move up the gears when it becomes more exciting. But then you mustn't make every game sound like the World Cup final, because then when you do finally get to the World Cup final, you've got nowhere to go. Also, a little bee in my bonnet now, as I listen to commentaries all the time, I suppose, is that I don't like commentaries being cluttered up with lots of meaningless facts and figures. I think you're there to describe the game.
And in those days at BBC Radio Derby, most local radio stations have a lot of loyal listeners who, you know, do support their local radio station. And I think you had then also lots of letters from visually impaired listeners sort of giving you possibly feedback and comments on your reporting and commentating. Can you remember any of those letters that they sent you?
Yes, I do. I can. And the letters I remember most of all from that time were, well, two lots of different kinds of letters, very different. I used to treasure the letters I used to treasure the letters I got from the forces overseas in terrible conflict situations, you know, who used to listen to the radio. I was very moved by getting letters from people in prison as well, who used to rely on the radio, and the visually impaired audience as well. They had a special programme at Radio Derby, actually, which was a duplicated with Radio Nottingham. And I used to get lovely letters, which just made it all worthwhile, you know, to receive those. And it kind of kept my feet on the ground, too.
And when you did make that move to BBC Radio Sport in Broadcasting House in London and working with some of those great broadcasters that you mentioned earlier on, you know, Cliff Morgan, Brian Butler, Peter Jones, etc., etc., what was it like taking your first steps into Broadcasting House?
Like the first day at school, really. because it was such a culture shock going from, you know, where I used to live in Derby, which is a couple of sort of traffic lights away from the radio station, and obviously it was one just big intimate happy family there. And then the commute to London every day was difficult to get used to. But then when you arrived at Broadcasting House, and I walked in on that first morning, the first Monday morning, and everyone seemed to have pre-assigned desks. Two rows, and I'm looking at, you know, Desmond Lynham, Christopher Martin Jenkins, Gerald Williams, Peter Jones, you know, they were all there on that Monday morning, sort of eyeing me up and down, you know, but then things evolve, and I ended up very fortunately having relationships with all of these people, like the ones I had at Radio Derby. Again, we were one big happy family in Broadcasting House. And Brian Butler, who was my predecessor as the football correspondent, he was, I've mentioned Peter, but what Brian, again, older listeners will remember, and this is an example of things that are better on radio, I think, than on television. Brian used to orchestrate and present the FA Cup draw from Lancaster Gate in London, the FA headquarters. And he presided over this, and it became a real institution. It was the way that he did it. It was very theatrical as he set the scene. And in fact, some people used to say that when he did it, you could almost smell the cigar smoke and the dust from the volumes of books, you know, around him at Lancaster Gate seeping through the wireless. It was wonderful. And, you know, he was just a master craftsman, was Brian. And I learned so much from him. And I just think that there are certain things. I watch the draw now on the television, and it's a real dog's dinner sometimes. And some things are best left to radio. I actually also think, I don't know if you'd agree with me or not, but I think it's better listening to football results on the radio than it is. Because if you don't know the score and you're listening for that inflection at the end to see whether your team have won or lost or drawn, there's nothing beats that for drama if you don't already know the score. Yeah, although television has in many ways sort of killed the radio star. And there are certain things still, I think, that radio is still on its own at doing.
And I suppose the relationship between football and the media and radio has changed so much over the years. And, you know, football has changed so much. I think in the book you say that after the 1966 World Cup, after England winning, which, you know, hopefully England might win again someday, but you know, football changed at that time. And I don't know whether you feel we can get back to those days where there is a closer link between the player and the fan and the team and the fan as well.
I suppose a lot depends on at what level you're watching the game. I think if you're asking me whether it will change in the Premier League, sadly it won't, I'm afraid. It just won't. But it can, there's still a chance lower down the leagues. When I first started watching, I used to go watching Derby County in Derby. We used to go sometimes, my dad and I, to the railway station because the visiting team would come in on the train. And we'd walk to the ground with the players. You know, we would literally walk to the baseball ground for half an hour from the railway station. And I can remember walking with some absolute giants of the game, Stanley Matthews, John Charles, you know, people like that, to the game. And they weren't bothered too much by autograph hunters or anything like that. They took it all in their stride. But I suppose one of the biggest changes now is that relationship between the supporter and the fans. And I don't like the idea of having these exclusive tunnel clubs now in the Premier League where you can get access to players, but only if you spend thousands and thousands of pounds to get that. I think that is sad. I mean, I used to, when I was a kid, I used to write to players for autographs, and 99% of them would reply back. And I hope that still happens nowadays. I hope it does. Again, though, another sign of the times, Toby, when you do get the autograph, but you can't read it now. If you see a player's autograph nowadays, it's just a squiggle. It's almost like, I'm too busy. Do this as quickly as possible. You know, whereas if you look at the autographs of people like Jimmy Armfield or Bobby Charlton or Bobby Moore, or Tom Finney, they're all pristinely written, you know. And also, they didn't, by the way, put their number of their shirt next to the name. They haven't got the audacity to do that. You know, they never assume that they own that shirt.
And I think you finally hung up your BBC commentator's microphone in 2016. How hard was it for you walking away from BBC Sport and Broadcasting, well, Broadcasting House, but it probably wasn't Broadcasting House, and it was probably Salford or somewhere.
It was a gradual exit because I did my last commentary in 2014. And then they asked me to, for 2 years, to do one or two special programmes. So that was interesting because I went back to my roots, if you like, because I'd started off before commentating as a presenter of Sport On 2. So I was interested to do that. I did half a dozen programmes for them in the end and finished in 2016. And as you say, the last programme that I ever introduced and was involved in for the BBC was the celebration of 1966, 50 years on. And the lovely thing about that programme was that one of the guests was Jimmy Armfield, who was a member of that England World Cup squad, who'd become a great friend of mine, great colleague, sadly passed away. And so that was the last time we worked together. In fact, it's probably the last time we even spoke to each other. And the lovely thing about Jimmy Armfield, and it really says everything that I admire about football and the way it was then and possibly isn't now. I don't know if you remember, but Jimmy was in the World Cup squad, but only the 11 players got medals on that day who won the World Cup. And Jimmy had been a former England captain, and he was still one of the first people on the pitch at the end, on the final whistle, beaming and hugging everybody, even though he knew he wasn't going to be going up to the Royal Box to get a medal. What was important to him was England and the overall, you know, the team ethic, and that was just wonderful. And said an awful lot about him as a person.
Yeah, which you probably wouldn't get nowadays with with football players, sadly. Well, Mike, thank you so much indeed for your time today and for chatting with me. It's been fantastic.
Thank you, Toby. Thank you.
And the book is absolutely wonderful. It was a great listen. I enjoyed listening to the whole book and some fabulous moments in there. But thank you so much.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for taking an interest in it. Thank you.
After extra time and penalties, Memoirs of a BBC Football Correspondent by Mike Ingham is published by Book Guild Publishing and available in audio, print and ebook. If you would like to listen to an extended version of Toby's interview with Mike Ingham, you can visit Toby's Audioboom channel, audioboom.com/channel/TobyVIP. And you can find Toby on Twitter, again, at TobyVIP.
Hello, I'm Richard Burnip, and I've been reading for RNIB Talking Books for several years now. I can't actually remember when I started. I think over the years I've done quite a range of books, but very often I seem to get ones that are quite weighty, for whatever reason. When I say quite weighty, I suppose I think of that because I've had things like The Island Race by Winston Churchill, The Condition of the Working Class in England by Engels, and Mein Kampf, Unabridged, which was a challenge. One of the books I really enjoyed was The Monk Cardinal, Basil Hume biography by Anthony Howard, because that was a fascinating portrait of a man and a world that I knew nothing about, all the sort of background to the internal politics of the Catholic Church, and this amazing portrait of this very remarkable man, and I found that a great book to do. Basil Hume served as Cardinal Archbishop of Westminster for 23 years, and his holiness and wisdom made him an extraordinary leader. In this biography, Anthony Howard, who has had unique access to Cardinal Hume's private papers and the people who knew him best, traces his life from his Newcastle upbringing through to his schooling at Ampleforth and his reign at Westminster, including his long and ultimately successful fight on behalf of the Maguire 7 and the Guildford 4. I got to know about RNIB Talking Books years ago when I was still a child, and my late grandmother in her final years had been an avid reader all her life. She devoured books all the time, and I hear stories like this all the time, but she lost most of her sight towards the end of her life and greatly enjoyed getting the old, I think, 8-track cartridges and the machine that you fitted them into to continue listening to books, some ones she'd read before, some that were new to her. And I think that was the first time I became aware that this was something
that wasn't just providing books for people to listen to randomly, but that it was a very valuable service. It's very nice to know as well that sometimes you're recording books that aren't going to be given a commercial release, that are just being recorded for the RNIB, and making what are often amazing books much more widely available than they would be. So I think I'm very fortunate to be doing these sort of recordings, and I think it's a lovely thing to read for the RNIB.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Now it's back to Alison Rudd for the books of her life. Alison, was there a book that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Well, if I'm completely honest, I just don't like fibbing read. I wanted to write before I knew what writing was, really. So it would be a lie for me to say a particular book opened my eyes to that. But a book that resonated and made me think how clever writing can be was The Getting of Wisdom by Henry Handel Richardson. It's set in Australia, and it's like an Australian version of Mallory Towers, but just written in a more literary way. It's about going to boarding school and not fitting in. So it's, on the one hand, a typical story that girls love when they're young, because if you don't go to boarding school, they sound so scary. But it's done beautifully, absolutely beautifully, and I would recommend it as someone to get for their kids or to read as an adult.
It is a shame. All the other girls will have dresses down to the tops of their boots, and they'll laugh at me and call me a baby. And touched by the thought of what lay before her, she too began to sniffle. She did not fail, however, to roll the dress up and to throw it into a corner of the room. She also kicked the ewer, which fell over and flooded the floor. Pin cried more loudly and ran to fetch Sarah. Nora returned to the garden. The two little boys came up to her, but she waved them back. "Let me alone, children. I want to think." She stood in a becoming attitude by the garden gate, her brothers hovering in the background. Then Mother called once more. "Nora, where are you?" "Here, Mother. What is it?" "Did you knock this jug over, or did Pin?" "I did, Mother." "Did you do it on purpose?" "Yes." "Come here to me." She went with lagging steps. But Mother's anger had passed. She was at work on the dress again, and by squinting her eyes, Laura could see that a piece was being added to the skirt. She was penitent at once, and when Mother, in a sorry voice, said, "I'm ashamed of you, Laura, and on your last day, too," her throat grew narrow. "I didn't mean it, Mother. If only you would ask properly for things, you would get them." Laura knew this, knew indeed that, did she coax, Mother could refuse her nothing. But coaxing came hard to her. Something within her forbade it. Sarah called her high-stomached, to the delight of the other children and her own indignation. She had explained to them again and again what Sarah really meant. On leaving the house, she went straight to the flower beds. She would give Mother, who liked flowers very well but had no time to gather them, a bouquet the size of a cabbage.
Justine Eyre narrating The Getting of Wisdom by Henry Handel Richardson, which is available commercially.
And is there a book that you'd like to curl up with and reread on a rainy day?
Well, that does imply an element of comfort reading, and also that rereading is a good thing. I'm dead against rereading on the basis that there are too many books in the world and you really, really shouldn't. But one book I have read twice because I was desperate to find out if I still loved it before I let my book club have a go at it was McTeague by Frank Norris, which I used to think was quite an obscure book and mine alone, and I was the only person in the world who knew about how wonderful this book was. But actually, it's on the wish list of Stephen King and David Bowie, so I'm in good company. It's turn of the century, American dream going wrong, and the most amazing book. And if it's raining outside and you want to lose yourself in something, this is the book to do it.
He made but few acquaintances. Polk Street called him the doctor, and spoke of his enormous strength, for McTeague was a young giant, carrying his huge shock of blonde hair 6 feet 3 inches from the ground, moving his immense limbs, heavy with ropes of muscle, slowly, ponderously. His hands were enormous, red, and covered with a fell of stiff yellow hair. They were hard as wooden mallets, strong as vices, the hands of the old-time carboy. Often he dispensed with forceps and extracted a refractory tooth with his thumb and finger. His head was square-cut, angular, the jaw salient, like that of the carnivora. Yet McTeague's mind was, as his body, heavy, slow to act, sluggish. Yet there was nothing vicious about the man. Altogether, he suggested the draft horse, immensely strong, stupid, docile, obedient. When he opened his dental parlors, he felt that his life was a success, that he could hope for nothing better. In spite of the name, there was but one room. It was a corner room on the second floor over the branch post office and faced the street. McTeague made it do for a bedroom as well, sleeping on the big bed lounge against the wall opposite the window. There was a washstand behind the screen in the corner where he manufactured his molds. In the round bay window were his operating chair, his dental engine, and the movable rack on which he laid out his instruments. 3 chairs, a bargain at the second-hand store, ranged themselves against the wall with military precision underneath a steel engraving of the court of Lorenzo de' Medici, which he had bought because there were a great many figures in it for the money. Over the bed lounge hung a rifle manufacturer's advertisement calendar, which he never used. The other ornaments were a small marble-topped center table covered with back numbers of the American system of dentistry, a stone pug dog sitting before the little stove, and a thermometer. A stand of shelves occupied one corner, filled with the 7 volumes of Allen's Practical Dentist. On the top shelf, McTeague kept his concertina and a bag of birdseed for the canary. The whole place exhaled a mingled odor of bedding, creosote, and ether. But for one thing, McTeague would have been perfectly contented. Just outside his window was his signboard, a modest affair that read, Dr. McTeague, Dental Parlors, Gas Given. But that was all. It was his ambition, his dream, to have projecting from that corner window a huge gilded tooth, a molar with enormous prongs, something gorgeous and attractive. He would have it someday, on that he was resolved, but as yet such a thing was far beyond his means.
Wolfram Kandinsky, narrating McTeague, written by Frank Morris, which is available commercially.
Finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
I'm often really late to the books that everyone's talking about. I almost don't like to read a book if I know everyone else is. Does that make me a snob? Probably. But because of lockdown, I have loads of bookcases, and I was sorting out books, and I found The Secret History by Donna Tartt. And people are always telling me it's one of their favourite books. So I thought, I'll give it a go. I'd read The Goldfinch, thought it was okay. And then when I told people that was okay, they said, no, you should read The Secret History. So I finally just got around to reading it. And although I wasn't completely blown away, I could not put it down. And that is the sign of a quite excellent book.
The snow in the mountains was melting, and Bunny had been dead for several weeks before we came to understand the gravity of our situation. He'd been dead for 10 days before they found him, you know. It was one of the biggest manhunts in Vermont history. State troopers, the FBI, even an army helicopter. The college closed, the dye factory in Hampton shut down, people coming from New Hampshire, upstate New York, as far away as Boston. It is difficult to believe that Henry's modest plan could have worked so well, despite these unforeseen events. We hadn't intended to hide the body where it couldn't be found. In fact, we hadn't hidden it at all, but had simply left it where it fell, in hopes that some luckless passerby would stumble over it before anyone even noticed he was missing. This was a tale that told itself simply and well. The loose rocks, the body at the bottom of the ravine with a break in the neck, and the muddy skid marks of dug-in heels pointing the way down. A hiking accident. No more, no less. And it might have been left at that, at quiet tears and a small funeral, had it not been for the snow that fell that night. It covered him without a trace, and 10 days later, when the thaw finally came, the state troopers and the FBI and the searchers from town all saw that they had been walking back and forth over his body until the snow above it was packed down like ice. It is difficult to believe that such an uproar took place over an act for which I was partially responsible. Even more difficult to believe I could have walked through it. The cameras, the uniforms, the black crowd sprinkled over Mount Cataract like ants in a sugar bowl, without incurring a blink of suspicion. But walking through it all was one thing. Walking away, unfortunately, has proved to be quite another, and though I once thought I had left that ravine forever on an April afternoon long ago, now I am not so sure.
The Secret History by Donna Tartt, which is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library.
Alison Rudd, thank you so much for sharing your passion for reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you for having me.
If you want to share the books of your life or ask us about anything that you've heard on Read On, the email address is radio@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. But don't forget to tune in at the same time next week, or you can always download the show as a podcast.
Just search for RNIB Audiobook Show Read On in your favourite podcast app. We're available on Apple, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and wherever you found this.
And if you can, why not rate, review, and leave us 5 stars?
Please do. Hitting like really helps us get the word out about Read On, the audiobook show.
You can find us on Twitter. I'm at RedSale, which is RedSzell.
And I'm at talking_books.
Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.